goal of these tools is to help people make decisions more in their interests related to climate change data. If they have the access to the data, they'll make better decisions, is like the logic behind them. A collaborator of mine did user testing with a small group in one of the most at-risk areas, and every single person who used the tool made decisions in what less in their interest after interacting with the tool. So the tool was actually training people in incorrect beliefs, and it's like a small sample and it's like early testing, but we do not want to have the opposite effect of what we're going for in terms of, like, we don't want this to be like a justification of historical racism by accident, which it could be, right? So
what would that look like?
A justification of historical racism?
I mean, somebody like Niall Ferguson could take it and spin it as a triumph of civilization as it spread over the globe. I mean, that would be the...
But, like, what would that literally...
Literally look
like? What would you have to do for it to look like that?
I mean,
I think garbage in, garbage out. If we did not do any of the filtering of language that we're talking about, if we created like a if you could like voyant tools like search anything without flagging key potentially problematic language, you could really easily create really fast visualizations that justify or amplify the more problematic to present day eyes aspects of the
Go ahead. There's like two levels at which you could do it, right? So you could filter the data set in such a way as to focus on the language around economic uplift, right? And then just build a visualization of the French talking about the areas of the globe that they have brought benefits of French progress to, you know, the kind of Marianne with the cornucopia of something far over the globe. So that's kind of really twisting the data set. And if the end user has enough access to the filters, that should be trivial to do. But then there's also the unintended consequence of a well-designed viewer still leading to the wrong conclusions. And that's the case of the C-Rise viewer. So in the C-Rise viewer, what you do is it gives you a bunch of different scenarios of if X amount of sea rise, this is what it would look like, and this is what's underwater. Ostensibly, that should make somebody go, oh, hell, like I really need to think about my energy consumption and my CO2 footprint. Instead, what the end users ended up doing was going, my house is just outside of an 8-meter rise, so I'm fine. And they did that, no matter what happened, they were able to figure out, so it was 8 meters there underwater, they kicked it down to 7, I'm fine. And so they used the tool to kind of, to excuse themselves from having to really think about the implications of what the data is suggesting. Even though there was not really any particular twist in how, I mean, these were all varying degrees of data-backed scenarios of sea level rise. And so there's two levels at which we need to worry about it. One, the kind of p-hacking, how much could somebody really twist what the maps are showing? But then two, also really thinking through the implications of the way we've intended it to be designed versus the way people end up perceiving it.
And this second one is harder to control, but it's out of control. But you may, I don't know, include the annotations in this direction.
There are a lot of digital humanities projects function on the level of the more the better. The more one can play with the data. And I think maybe, and this goes to Carol's point, I mean, I think one of the things that you're raising is the difference of audience.
Absolutely.
So it may be a level of building tiered interfaces, one for a scholarly audience, one for the public.
Yeah.
I don't think the public would have the background knowledge and contextual knowledge to know, okay, if I'm filtering it in such a way, I'm really getting skewed results. I mean, just in my classes, I do a lot of work to teach them that Google is not showing them everything, right? And Google says, oh, they found like 150 billion results on that thing you searched, until you actually scroll to the end and you find out it found 152 things and just lied to you and made it look like the paginator went on forever. And so kind of common conceptions around data is one, that it's complete. So OutStudio does a lot of work to say this is an incomplete data set. Because one could, if he provided, he does provide some filters, but if he had provided more, one could filter the graph in such a way as to show there weren't any lynchings in the American West, which the historiography in the last decade has gone at great lengths to show, yes, in fact, there were a lot of lynchings in the American West, and that it was more about a general sense of white supremacy and less about a kind of concentrated in the American South, and then therefore excusing the North and the American West. And so these are the sorts of concerns that we have about taking a set, as Doris indicated, that is already so ideologically laden, and then kind of putting it up, you know, in politically in France, for instance. I mean, one of the big hot button issues that a lot of my colleagues in the French Academy deal with is how do we understand race? How do we address race? You know, I've had colleagues shouted down at conferences saying that, you know, it doesn't have a race problem, that is an importation of American conceptualizations of race. So one could read the map in that way. I mean, these are all kinds of things that we're trying to consider at this point.
But I think, like, when you're talking about the difference between a public interface versus a scholarly interface, you know, where one is more static and tells the story you want to tell with the data. I mean, most of the general public just wants to know what are your conclusions, and the visualization should show what that conclusion is.
Right.
But the scholarly one, maybe people want to interrogate the data. They want to use a different tool. I mean, but whatever it might be. I mean, I've seen scholars throw the same data set at 10 different tools and get different results every time. And so it's not like the data is not telling you something through that visualization. Basically, the visualization should visualize your conclusion as a scholar in terms of understanding and analyzing that data. So, I mean, it's like changing the paint color on a house. I mean, the house is still the same, and you can make it look very different on the outside. But
what's the house in this metaphor?
The house is the data, is the structured data. And then you can put a lot of different colors and things on top of it, and they tell a different story, right? You can make it look any way you want to make it look.
But I think this is the point of visualization, to allow people to explore and find their own insight.
I recall some of the debate taking place when I was in France, because in post-colonial studies, on the one side, from the colonized people, they say, oh, you came, we never invited you to come, you colonized, you looted our countries and so on. And from the European side, most of the time they would counter by saying, oh, we came in, we built roads, we built hospitals, we built schools and so on. So to counter the argument. So when using this kind of data, I keep wondering, which one should we? Of course, they built this, but does that justify colonialism? So which was supposed to be a civilizing mission? You see, so how do we weigh these two sides? I recall also another book. It was written by a French scholar. I cannot recall the title. It was about Algeria, and he said that, well, Algerians are blaming France for many of their shortcomings. But when we went to Algeria, we invested a huge amount of money. We never got anything back. We lost the money going there. And that argument was used by many French scholars to say, well, we told you so. Colonialism was not meant to benefit the metropole. So we went there just to civilize. We lost even a huge amount of money while going there. So, pardon?
C'était une bonne action.
Oui, well. So you see, that's a kind of argument and counter argument we see in this debate all the time. So I'm afraid that if we leave this to scholars to be making their own argument, we will be staying in the same vicious cycle. So I know it's always tricky to suggest That you, everything you said, I was just smiling because we, you know, on the one hand, we have these unbelievable tools, but you can use it for your own purposes. So how do you give to the reader the best information and objective information, giving both sides account?
So this is the main takeaway of my work, is that it's never objective, no matter how
much you try. I was about to say that, like, it's never objective.
Okay.
But what you say, Charles, about there's always this dichotomy, maybe we can think about like two dominant views in a visualization, like that history from below.
Because the history is, it's one history, it's just interpreted on either side in a different way, from a different perspective.
Mary, what? I feel like you just, like, threw that on the table.
All right, go ahead.
In the room,
you
like,
go, it's interpreted
in
different
ways. I mean, what your limitation is your source material, right? So, you can't do something that is not possible with your source material. There are a lot of possibilities,
mm-hmm.
ones that have not been thought about, right? But you have a source and you don't have other sources. You also have a question that you care about. Imagine geographies. You might have other questions, but just for the purpose of kind of like, what are you gonna do with that? That is a, you know, the way we've been talking about it so far, that is an imagined geography of the people producing this periodical for a particular imagined audience that is likely not colonized peoples, right? And so your ability to not recreate the structures of colonialism in your analysis of this text is limited by what you want to do to answer that question about imagined geographies, which is still about, like, French people.
Right.
And so how, you know, within those parameters, what can you do to uncover, you know, the power dynamics of colonialism in this periodical?
And that's the main thing, is what, how do we, because they're going to be there, that's what we're trying to effectively visualize, but how do we efface them so that people are forced to confront them? And one of the concerns is, in one way other people have tried to address this, is to build a website around it, right, and to frame it. But one of the problems is visualizations are embeddable, and they have a life afterward, particularly in the area of social media, so people will take a visualization, snapshot it, and now a thing that 30 people have visited your website becomes viral, 3,000 people see just the snapshot of the visualization, and they draw a conclusion from there. And so one of the challenges then becomes making sure that you're embedding in the visualization a way of conveying the, or effacing the colonial.
Well, yeah,
power,
but
dynamics.
You, I mean, I think this is what, like, a couple of people have said, is you can't control everything, right?
Well, right.
You can't, you can do the best that you can do to make an argument in prose, visually, that makes, you know, a significant contribution to this debate, but you can't make all the arguments, and you can't foresee all of the crazy things that people might do. You can't predict every reader reaction. And you can't correct everything, right? It's not our job to correct the source. It's our job to analyze what's there and understand why that's going on, and to interpret the consequences, the relationships between those rhetorical choices, and you can visualize that in a way that demonstrates an understanding of the contingency and temporality of colonialism in relation to the ways that we think about, you know, naming peoples and places today, or the economics of post-colonial trade, I mean, things like this, right? But you can't fix it.
We can problematize it, though. Like,
yes.
We can problematize the use of the visualization medium.
Yes.
And also, it's a question of linearity. The more multilinear the visualization, the more space there is for... So, like, partly what you're describing is the historian's process in writing a linear monograph, right? And so you make decisions as you go to present the data in the way that best reflects both the source material and the interpretation of that source material. In a visualization, you could do that as kind of a visual narrative, almost like story mapping, right, where you walk someone through and you show. But that's a, even though it's dynamic in the sense that people can click next and it's multimedia, and it's still a very linear on the rails
mm-hmm.
interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to kind of more multilinear, multifaceted visualization,
mm-hmm.
which would probably be arguably more useful to other researchers and make it have a much wider reach that has, opens up the possibility of a lot more abuse.
I think you can. It's right. You can't control, but you can open your site with some stories or suggestions, showing the idea or your thoughts, or coming up with some prints already and. Tell the stories, showing what you've found so far. This can help. Another thing, I was thinking, when I showed some people yesterday a physical visualization of slave voyages
mm-hmm.
using beads, and one bead represented 10,000 people. And when my student came up with that, I thought, oh, it will show that there was not that huge amount of people, because one bead, but it was impossible to make it with one bead representing 1,000 instead,
right.
Because it will be a gigantic diameter. It will be impossible to handle, to mount it. But I was afraid because of the ethical thought should we are showing the wrong idea? But sometimes you can't help, so.
Well, because there's also, I mean, there's the small teeth truth of it, right? That you could read it and go, that each beat's 10,000, and you calculate it out and draw a conclusion there. And there's also the impressionistic, right? And so if one beat's 10,000 or one beat's 100,000, just the impression that one leaves with of the importance or the weight or the gravitas. I mean, this is kind of like the kind of activist art, right? Where you wouldn't maybe perhaps intentionally make
mm-hmm.
a visualization that is so impossible and so impossibly huge that no one could even see it, just to give the impression of how huge this was,
mm-hmm.
which is very different than the kind of, you know, like in a textbook where you boil down the slave voyages into a digestible chart in the corner.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are two very, and that's part of what we're trying to consider too, is how much do we want to get them, you know, at the more kind of visceral, emotional, you know, this is what it was like, this imagined geography, how the, not just like the kind of cerebral, this is how the French saw the world, but that kind of bigger emotional affect part of it.
What about if we had like fixed pathways through the visualization that were like, as Mary said, like presenting conclusions that we've determined are like ethical and what we want people to do, like guided, annotated journeys through the visualization, but then there was an option to take the training wheels off, sort of, but then to access those tools, there's some kind of like the memorandum of understanding in Monroe Work Today, like there's a kind of, you realize what you're doing, like an educational element of now, like,
you
and
to
then
apply. I mean, that's a question for everybody. Like, what would you think as scholars of some degree,
I mean,
of access control? I mean, because we've talked about, like Carol was mentioning, for all researchers, there's some researchers that, you know, like, just because they've got a PhD after their name and they're at an institution doesn't mean I think they would be the most ethical with my data set.
I'm thinking about, and this is just like thinking about, like, you're creating a monograph, right?
Yeah.
And then you have the source data. and the tools you used and how you did that work, so reproducible, right? And so maybe think about it, can think about it in that way, where you're creating again this, you know, this pathway that matches up to the analysis you've done that is ethical, and then just you know, making that source material available, but again with all the caveats.
I know that's something that happens with health sciences, if you want to share data, but there's maybe something a little concerning with the data, like there's patient information. Mm-hmm. If you want other scholars to be able to use it, you do create kind of like a layer where they have to contact you and agree to certain things, so that way you have some control over that.
Yeah. They can sign through an agreement to get access to sensitive data.
But we're just talking about text files. I mean, anything you do to enrich the data, you know, you can publish, and, but that should be open access, so that's open. Like, I don't think you want to play, I don't think you want to be a gatekeeper to your data.
Mm.
For, it's not your data,
no.
Except the enrichments that you do. But if you publish it, then that is also
but even
available.
Making it machine encoded is already an enrichment from its current state. I mean, this is the argument
sure.
around like data privacy.
Sure.
Right. So once you know the data is out there, everyone's consented to. But once you aggregate that data, it actually becomes something vastly different.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the move that I'm concerned about. Is that yes, it's on the BNS website. You can go access it, but you have to go through and read it all.
Yeah.
Once it's been transformed into something with a couple clicks. That you can start drawing associations, then that's different.
Yeah, yeah. I have a lot of conversations with a lot of people who hold their data very close to their hearts and have done for 30 years, and it's incredibly frustrating. And they do it because they're proud of the work that they did,
mm-hmm.
and with good reason. But
maybe you could have it both ways. Maybe you could have this. I mean, three things. You have the guided tour, you have the sort of the signing through, not you know, just saying, yeah, I agree that I understand that this is what
training
I'm gonna
wheels
be
are
doing.
Off.
Training wheels are off, I'm gonna be doing something different and have the visualization tools there. But the third way is to just have the data somewhere which you can get in a data repository where you have how you created it, what you did to the data, you know, where the source material came from. You know, so that you're creating the archive,
mm-hmm.
and that another scholar could come and use in a very different way to tell a very different story from what you're telling from that data. Whereas the other two, the guided tour and the sort of training wheels off, are more within a website that you've created.
How do other people feel about that? Is that something that seems attractive to use or pliable to make in your experience?
Yeah, I mean, so I'm pretty, I'm strongly against the gatekeeping aspect as well. I mean, not just for the questions of reproducibility, which I think in this kind of quantitative empirical environment, you want people to be able to reproduce your work in a way that lets them trust it more. But more than that, if you cast yourself in the role of a gatekeeper, it sends the impression that you're the arbiters of ethical behavior, which you probably don't want.
Right.
Yeah.
But it could be just a simple, you know, it doesn't have to be more like, you know, as you cross this barrier, you know, you must behave ethically. You can simply say, you know, this is sensitive data, there are potential issues with it, just, I agree that I understand that. Or even just, they don't have to agree, they just step through that, continue. And, you know, you can keep it pretty limited, but it's ethical. Let's see, I'm trying to think of another, like, a real-world example. You know, just signing, I agree with user cookies being on my phone, or,
yeah,
you know, it's just,
it's a
notification.
Awareness, not necessarily gatekeeping.
Yeah, so it's not stopping you from going forward, but it's giving you a little bit of context before you go forward.
Yeah, I definitely like to avoid the, I agree to the reams of terms and conditions that I've never read approach.
Yeah.
If we could have some kind of step through that's like...
The fine print.
What's that?
The fine print.
Exactly. Yeah, right.
Well, it's kind of like a code of conduct at a
right.
conference, right?
Exactly.
Where it just says, you know, by registering you agree that you will abide by a code of conduct. I mean, it doesn't even have to be that stringent, but it's something like...
Yeah.
I'm just understanding where this came from and...
I mean, there are journal like... For cultural analytics, or there's this new journal for, I forget what it's called, open humanities data, that Barbara is the co-editor of, you can publish your data set and write it up, right? So, and that's an opportunity for you to talk about the enrichment work that you did, its origins of the BANF, and your kind of considerations on the ethics of potential reuse, obviously not being able to imagine all possibilities.
Right.
And, you know, the data set is published, you have this contextual information, and people can, you know, access it in that way, you know, which is not purely just a link in a repository.
Right.
Right.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Then
you have context within that repository of exactly
and
how
then,
you created it, what you did to it, ethical consideration.
And then it can get reviewed, right? In that.
I like
that
that approach because I think there are two different operations. I think one needs to come before the other. I actually think that the visualization, the more linear on the rails visualization argument, based on the workflow, needs to be done first. Then think about how far can you open it up in the visualization space itself while still maintaining the initial goal that you had in mind. And I think releasing the data set actually needs to come afterward. Because at that point, it's about now we consider the data set as an object. And then what's the, and I think reviewing it, and not just reviewing the set, but also reviewing the ancillary materials that contextualize the set is an important process. Personally, I don't want to be gatekeeper in favor of open access, but I do think that as we continue moving into a 21st century of a data saturated environment, these are things we need to think about of what data and how should it be open and how far should people be able to access it.
And how much do you save people from themselves? So one thing coming out of this ethical visualization work is the concept of compassionate interfaces. So how many people here are familiar with dark patterns? So dark patterns is part a concept from user experience design when you want a user to do a certain thing that they probably don't want to do. You guide their behavior in the interface to get them to do the thing you want. So this is the principle of why we stay on Facebook for so long, or social media in general. It's disadvantageous to my life to spend 2 hours on Twitter in one go. But the interface is designed to take advantage of, you know, the primitive parts of my brain being addicted to the interface, right? So this is a dark pattern, and a more explicit example is when a website or app switches around the yes and no buttons, or the color of them, the position of them. So dark patterns is a really standard way of designing user interfaces to get people to stay on your site, to get more advertising revenue, to get people to agree to uses of their data that they wouldn't want if they were truly informed and truly consenting. So the flip side of that is this idea of compassionate interfaces. So there's a lot of people working in the not-profit tech sector and advocacy, data advocacy work on how to make technology work with and complement human conditions rather than manipulate them, or as a balance to these. So this idea of what Chris is saying about the importance of the guided pathways first is, yes, we can't control everything, but we can take advantage of these known psychological principles that now in Silicon Valley culture it is common to use against people's interests for purposes of revenue. It's also possible, particularly in a humanities nonprofit context, to take those same known principles and use them to design user pathways and interfaces that are more in people's interests.
And I realize now that another expert we could have included would be someone from museums. Because museums deal with this, right? So they have a guided pathway, but having the guided pathway alone does not then protect the museum from someone coming and looking at the artifacts on display I mean, in drawing the wrong conclusion. This was a huge concern for the African American History Museum by the Smithsonian. They spent a long time trying to figure out how to do it well. And so I think, yeah, I don't know if I have any other, other than like 2020 of who else we should have invited.
Yeah, I don't know that they've done it well either. I mean, I think sometimes